Hi, my name is Aida Puri. It's September 16, 2022, and we are recording at Street Sense Media. And today we are interviewing Wendell Williams. Wendell, I need to know something about your childhood and the early life and school life. When and where were you born?
First of all, I'm a native Washingtonian. But it goes deeper than that. I'm a five-generation, verifiable Washingtonian. I have a copy of my great-great-grandparents' marriage certificate. And because when they were born in the district, they weren't considered whole persons, they weren't eligible for a marriage license. But the fact that they were Catholic meant that they were records kept. And we have the marriage certificate from the church for my great-great-grandparents as well as my great-grandparents. My great-grandparents were married in Washington, D.C. in 1889. They were born in 1861 and 1862, respectively, in Washington, D.C. So when they say a native Washingtonian, that's kind of a cavalier saying that you'll hear around here. But, you know, I'm fortunate and I'm proud to say I can trace my existence in Washington, D.C. Back for five generations or so. I grew up initially in the Berry Farms housing project of Southeast Washington, which a lot of people don't know was actually a farm and one of the larger farms within the boundaries of Washington, D.C. It stretches from the, it initially stretched from the current day Martin Luther King Avenue all the way to the water because there was no Bowling Air Force Base or 295 or rail tracks at that time. Berry Farms was purchased by the Freedmen's Bureau, and it was part of the Civil War Reconstruction efforts. And so for generations, African Americans existed on that property. And in about 1948, after World War II, while the rest of the American veterans had things like Levittstown, that would lead to home ownership for the veterans. Black veterans received the opportunity to go into public housing as a stepping stone to maybe housing ownership. So when I was born, my parents had just moved into Berry Farms, and we lived in Berry Farms from 1950 to 1958. And we lived in Berry Farms when Berry Farms was a completely different animal than we hear about today. It was nice lawns, flowers in the yard, all kind of community camaraderie and atmosphere and activities. And as a kid, I remember standing on Stevens Road, and we had a clear line of sight to the fireworks when they would do the fireworks on the mall for 4th of July. And I have some of my best experiences as a child in Berry Farms. It was not the scary, dangerous place that the media likes to talk about today that led to its being demolished. And I also did a story about my life in Berry Farms for Street Sense, I may add. So yeah, we were there until I was 8. And at 8 years old, my dad bought a house which we still own and still in the family. And we moved to about 2 blocks from RFK Stadium on the northeast side. And what was significant about that was the same street my dad had grew up on. And my dad came from Waterfall, Virginia, which is an unincorporated township at the foot of the Bull Run Mountains in what's now presently West Prince William County. And him and my grandmother on his side, they moved there in that Heckinger Mall, Rosedale area in 1936. So in 1958, we bought a house literally on that same street. So that's where I grew up. And I went to Holy Comforter School at 15th and East Capitol Street, Northeast. And after that, I went to Mackin Catholic High School at 14th and V, Northwest. And I finished at Eastern High School at 17th and East Capitol.
Well, thank you very much. You've pretty much summed it up pretty much about what, how you grew up. And that's wonderful that you've been here and your family for five generations. That's awesome. That's definitely awesome. Can you also tell me what changes have you seen today in D.C. compared to when you were growing up back in the 60s and 70s?
It's mind-blowing. I just want to preface my comments with keep in mind the fact that I'll be 72 in a couple of months. So I've seen the whole process of D.C. kind of evolve twice. For example, when we lived in Berry Farms, all of Southeast was white. There were only two pockets of black people in Southeast at that time. That was Berry Farms and Douglas Dwellings, which has now been turned into a townhouse project right there on that new shopping center on Alabama Avenue where they have that new Giant and the IHOP. Those were the two pockets of black people living in Southeast. All of what we call Congress Heights, all of the Good Hope Road, Anacostia High School, all that area was not predominantly, it was lily white. And in the 50s and early 60s, it was more of that Fonzie, Happy Days kind of guys with the hair combed back with the leather jackets on and the motorcycle boots on. And it was real polarizing to be that pocket of blackness within that sea of people who didn't look like us. So we had to travel in bands as we would try to make our way down to Good Hope Road. They had a 5 and 10 there. I think it was a Woolworths on Good Hope Road between, I think, 13th Street and Martin Luther King. And when I grew up, it was called Nichols Avenue, not Martin Luther King, in that Good Hope Road area where Bread for the City is now. It was extremely dangerous to go over there, to give you an idea of what I'm talking about. St. Teresa's of Avalon, the church right there. It was an all-white Catholic church, and the black residents of that area, we went to Our Lady of Perpetual Help. So it was pretty segregated in Southeast then. And then I saw when we moved to Northeast, when we first got there, it was maybe 50-50, 60-40 blend of black families and white families, and within a short period of maybe 2 years, it was all black. And so when we moved to Northeast, that was during the height of what sociologists call white flight. And we knew nothing about Temple Hills and Capitol Heights and Oxon Hill and Sutton. We knew nothing about that. But that's where all the people moved to, the closer in suburbs of Washington is where the white flight finally moved to. And so we saw D.C. Sort of switch over and obtain the term that we affectionately loved, and that was Chocolate City. And the term used to be Chocolate City with its vanilla suburbs. That's how it was referred to, and it was made famous by a song by the Parliament Funkadelic called Chocolate City. So we saw the town switch then, and we slowly saw it switch back to now my dad's house, which my younger brother still lives in. I would say my block is less than 50% black. My street and my neighborhood is predominantly white now. And the only people left in my neighborhood who are people who somehow managed to hold on to the homes that their parents and grandparents left them. So I've seen my neighborhood go from 50-50 when we moved in to all black to now that it's basically all white. And we've seen the changes in the, that go along with that that phenomenon. My high school, Eastern High School, is now a growing school. When it was all black when I was there, 4,500 students. It's slowly moving toward it looking closer to something you'd see in one of the private or charter schools. It's an academic school now. And I can remember coming off of 17th and Benning Road, driving south towards Pennsylvania Avenue on 17th Street. And I got to about C Street, and I hadn't seen a black person. And I started to wonder, when am I going to see a black person in my own neighborhood next to my own high school? And I didn't see another a black person until I got to about Independence Avenue. So that kind of gives you the vision of the change. And so now it's going back to what it was, as more people value living in the city, whereas in the generations previous to me, they wanted to get out of the city. And the young people today of all kinds want to be in the core of the city. And so I've seen it change, and then change again. And I can only imagine the future change, because I don't think anybody who's a working class person or a struggling person is going to be able to afford to live in D.C. For example, my dad paid $8,000 for that house. Eight in 1958, kind of numerology, right? The house next door to us, and we live on a corner. The house next door to us just sold for $690 in as-is condition. And then I looked at some of the apartments that my neighbors and some of my friends, we couldn't wait to get an apartment in this development or this section of our neighborhood. And I can remember my first apartment on, I lived at 424 Newcomb Street Southeast, and that is off Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. And I paid $85 a month, and that was in 1972. And you can't get anything in the areas of this town that you consider to be kind of on the frontier for less than $1,500 or so. So I see where the changes in this city is going to create even more imbalance and inequity in terms of housing and people being able to survive and still stay in this city. I find it very hard to conceive of how poor people or native Washingtonians who don't have a certain income are going to be able to stay in this city, because this expansion or gentrification or whatever you want to call it, we used to feel like it would stop at the river. We used to like would retreat mentally and say, okay, all on this side of the Anacostia belong to us or the people or whatever group you're talking about. Now that gentrification is behind the lines, and all you have to do is show up at the Southern Avenue Metro, Anacostia Metro, or Congress Heights Metro in the morning and notice who's walking into the subway station, not driven or getting off the bus, but walking, which would indicate that those areas are subtly changing. It's just that visually we may not see that change as pronounced as we've seen it in other parts of the city. So, you know, I left my high school and I went to DC Teachers College, which was created when Minor School for Colored Women was merged with the Wilson College. And prior to 1954, there were two educational systems in DC, prior to Brown versus the Board of Education. And Minor College, which kind of morphed into the college to train black teachers, and Wilson was the college to train white teachers. In 1954, they were forced to merge to train all teachers, And that created what we call DC Teachers College, and that's where I went to college. And it's on the campus of Howard University. You'll ride by it every day as you go down Georgia Avenue, and this real Victorian big building sits right on the hill across from Banneker Playground next to the Howard University Administration Building. That is the old Matilda Minor School for Colored Women that transformed into DC Teachers College. That's where I went to college.
Okay, Mr. Wyndham, what are some of the places that stand out to you in your memory, like?
Of DC?
Mm-hmm.
The zoo. and there's a sinister reason why. Again, I don't want to make a lot of my comments along these lines, but you are asking me to tell the truth mm-hmm. from my perspective. The zoo was important to black people in DC because it was one of the few places we could go. You must remember when I grew up, we couldn't go to the amusement parks. And I'm just 70-something, mm-hmm. right? So I don't want people to forget that. I've seen it in my lifetime and experienced it.
Mm-hmm, sure.
There was an amusement park called Glen Echo Amusement Park. It's just a little bit northwest of American University, straight out Mass Avenue, around the trail, Glen Echo Park. Crystal Pool is what I remember. And I used to see the ads on the TV about dipping in the crystal pool in the summertime, and to think I couldn't go in that pool or ride that roller coaster or dance in that crystal ballroom that they had outside. And it was a long bus ride away, and there was a special bus that you used to catch at 14th and K that would take you to Glen Echo all the way through the city to go to Glen Echo. I remember that. I remember stuff like the Pick Temple show that used to come on Channel 5. It was like a kid's show and came on like 4 or 5 o'clock, and was sponsored by Giant Food Stores. And I remember the jingle. It was my favorite bread's Heidi. I hope it's yours too. And if you eat it, all giant rangers will grow up big and strong. Something like that. Real catchy thing that I still remember, what, 60 some years, almost 70 years ago from that program. And at that particular time, I was not aware of the divisions in DC. So I never asked why nobody like me was ever on that show in the kids' gallery. And the first time I got aware of that is on the same channel, WTTG. They had one day a week where young black teenagers could come on and dance. It was called the Milt Grant Show. And it was like the local version of Bandstand. And every city had one. In Baltimore, they had one, and theirs was made famous by John Waters' film, John Waters, about the kind of large girl.
Hairspray.
Thank you very much. And that was a chronicle of that local show. And it took me a while to understand why only black music and black teenagers on the show on Thursdays. And so, you know, I saw a lot of things, but I didn't understand why. And it took a while for me to like kind of line it up with, oh, that is this way because of that. To give you an example, we could not shop at Garfinkel's when I was growing up. Garfinkel's is on the corner of 14th and G. We could not shop at Garfinkel's. There were a couple of department stores we could not shop at. I remember we couldn't eat in the cafeteria of Woody's. And Woody's used to have a awesome cafeteria, because at that time all department stores had cafeterias, and you could use your credit card from the store to charge food at those cafeterias. My mom used to take me to some of those department store cafeterias as a treat to eat. And I just remember that the zoo was probably my favorite place, because there was a tradition that still carried on today that I don't think people understand why. But Easter Monday has always been the day that black families took their families to the zoo in DC. And the reason it was started was because we couldn't go to other places because of segregation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there any restaurants or stores that are no longer here but you miss?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I miss Stevenson's Bakery. And if you're a native Washingtonian, you know about Stevenson's Bakery. It used to have these checkerboard or chessboard boxes that everything came in. And that's just like just burnt into my memory from growing up in Southeast, let alone D.C. It is now where the exchange is of Pennsylvania Avenue and 295. That's where it used to sit, right? Where Pennsylvania Avenue and 295, that exchange is where, right there in that exit to go on, that's right where Stevenson's Bakery used to be. And I remember Holgate's, and I remember Phillips over in the Wharf area. Going there, and then again, those were one of the few places that we could get things to go. I can remember my parents going to pick up seafood and everything from some of the restaurants at the Wharf, but we'd have to eat it in Anacostia Park at one of the picnic tables and stuff. And as a kid, you don't know why. But we used to eat right there by the Anacostia River in informal picnics as we went to the to there. One of the other places I used to love was the old Landsberg's and Cannes department store. And they were on 7th Street. Now, the building is still called the Landsberg Building, but it is the home of the Shakespeare Theater now on 7th Street, which I just recently saw the Merchant of Venice there. Updated version of the Merchant of Venice there. And so those buildings have been repurposed, but those were one of the two major department stores that blacks could shop in. One was called Cannes, and the other one's called Landsberg, and the building is still called Landsberg. You know, I remember those places fondly, but when I talk about memories of D.C., and if you're my age, you'll remember it, D.C. at Christmas time, I think we rivaled Times Square and Macy's Parade kind of stuff. Because in D.C. we had these elaborate mechanical displays in the windows of all stores and shops downtown for Christmas. And they would have sound, lights, moving figures. And the tradition was to take your family down D.C., park your car and walk around. And this is something that segregation did not prevent us from doing. So that was a big part of our existence at the holidays, was to go downtown park and go to every store. And the department stores used to compete to try to best one another as who had the best mechanical and musical display. And this is something from a bygone era of growing up in the city. And then we would leave there and drive to Upper 16th Street to look at lights on people's houses. So, you know, those are some of my fond memories of things that, you know, we did here in D.C. You got to remember there were only four channels. It's Channel 4, Channel 5, Channel 7, and Channel 9. That was it. No cable, no Channel 14, no Channel 50, or none of that. And television actually went off at 11:30. Okay. Television went off, and you hear that. Good evening. We'd like to thank everybody for watching today, and we're going to end the evening with our national anthem. And then they would have the jets flying, you know, in the screen on the TV program. You see the jets flying across the screen, and then it would fade to black. So, you know, we had not a lot of things to do in terms of what young people have today. And so we had to find a lot more things to do that I consider to be a little more healthy and promoted more of a family kind of existence, because this city used to be just pockets of neighborhoods made up of families and extended family within about 10 blocks of where I grew up at. I had maybe 50 family members, and I wrote about that in Street Sense as well. On this one block, both of my grandmothers lived next door to each other. Yes, my father married the girl next door. And then on the other side, my mother's brother married the girl on that side. So all three grandmothers were side by side. So Christmases and holidays was a big thing. And so everything then used to be surrounding the family and community. And the communities was just the sum of a lot of families with a lot of extended family members in those particular areas, which gave the D.C. neighborhoods what I consider to be the safety, the flavor, and the compassion and the caring for one another.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to ask about your experience with Street Sense Media. I need to know, how and when did you first hear about Street Sense Media?
You know, that's another question that there's not a simple answer to. I can simply say that I've been in the street newspaper movement since 1997, long before there was a Street Sense. And I think that tempers some of my attitudes and some of my responses to some of the things about the papers. I've been in it long, and the Street Sense has been in existence. I first started in Cleveland with the Cleveland Grapevine. Donald Whitehead is my friend and mentor. When I lived in Cincinnati, he took us to Cleveland to be trained and to find out about this new phenomenon at the time, which was street newspapers. Actually, the street newspaper movement is 47 years old, and it was created as a result of a book written by a formerly homeless guy by the name of Lee Stringer. And the name of the book is Grand Central Winter. And a lot of neighborhoods in New York were experiencing a lot of confrontation between people who were, that's kind of another way of me saying it, panhandling or asking for money in the new gentrifying neighborhoods. You know them, Chelsea, Bowery, you could name them, Soho. And so they came up with something like a newsletter to exchange for a gift or a donation, which kind of in a de facto way created the street newspaper movement. And it's kind of ironic that New York City is one of the only major cities in the country that doesn't have a street newspaper. So, you know, we learned all about the street newspapers in Cleveland at the various conferences and stuff. And then we sold the Cleveland paper with an insert with four pages of Cincinnati news just inserted in the Cleveland paper. And then at a certain time, we spun off onto our own Cincinnati paper, which was called Street Vibes. And if you notice about the street newspaper movement, there's a large number of the papers that have the word street in it. And they have the word change in it. And they have the word real in it. Or they have the word talk in it. As you go around the country and around the world, you can just look at the names of those papers, and they usually have those words in the name. And so I started selling the paper that way. And immediately it was like a natural fit for me, because my background is in media. I spent 22 years in radio and television before succumbing to and becoming homeless, which I went in and out of chronic homelessness over a 20-year period. The various false starts at returning to self-sufficiency. But that experience, it led me to see immediately the potential in selling the paper. And initially, my real reason for selling the paper was because of this boost of self-esteem that I felt when I was back out in public and interacting with people. And it kind of took me out of this shell I had retreated to because of untreated mental illness and substance issues. So I just noticed that when I would be out on that street selling the paper, I felt alive. I didn't feel like some anonymous person in a corner of life. And I began to make relationships and cement relationships by conversing and stuff with the people and selling the paper. The paper gave me a chance to get out of myself and do something for something other than myself. Make no doubt about it. I mean, I do benefit from the sales of an individual paper, but more important to me is that I out and I sell the movement and I represent the movement in a way that would make the founders of this movement proud. And I had a chance to meet some of the founders of this movement. So when my mentor and friend came to Washington, D.C. to take the position as the executive director of the National Homeless Coalition, when I got back to D.C., he called me up and says, hey, we're thinking about starting a paper here. And next thing I know, the paper was up and running. And then finally it moved here to its current headquarters here at the Church of Epiphany. And that's when I started selling the paper. My badge number is 64, which means, you know, I was one of the first 50 or 60 people to sell the paper, because we're currently badging, 700 and something. So I was here for almost the whole first 20 years. I think I started selling the paper in the third edition or something right in there. Some of my good friends, like Augustus, he has badge number 1. I think Jake had badge number 3. And so some of my good friends, we started off in this paper early on, have very low badge numbers. And a lot of us could see from the beginning that it was a chance to improve our situation. But I had a vision, and I just didn't know how I was going to make that vision work. And when I got involved with Street Sense the second time, because I had been initially, then I left and came back, my vision was clear. But more importantly, it was clear to me how I could use Street Sense to get me to that destination. And what I did was I sold papers on a schedule just like I had a real job. And I was able to pay for a domicile where I put myself back to school. And I was able to go to school and finish what I was doing, and then get licensed and certified in a couple of disciplines, which allows me to be employed today in the capacity for a local government. But make no doubt about it, I continue to do the paper so I can be an ambassador for the paper and let people know that this issue hasn't gone anywhere, and that they now have a choice or an option between giving money to a faceless or a person that's not known to them who is asking for money on street corners. Then now they have an option of looking for that man or woman who is selling the paper, and they could get a little bit of return on their donation, a better return, a known entity as to where that money is probably going and all thing, and be a part of a change process for more than that person that you got the paper from. So I love what I do Monday through Friday, but I also love going out on the weekend and marketing the paper. And one of the things that I really like is how people's attitude towards me on Saturday and Sunday when I distribute the paper is different from people's attitudes toward me when I pull up and I encounter them in my capacity as working for a government. It's like they make a lot of assumptions when they see me with the paper. And I have to remind them that the paper is for those who are poor or experiencing homelessness. And so I've noticed that as my life has gotten better, and other people that I know as their lives have gotten better, people's donations decrease to us. Because a lot of that dynamic is their need to feel superior or pity or sympathy for you. So here's $10. But when you start to like wear clean clothes, maybe sober up, maybe be a little clearer in your thinking, and they don't tend to reward that for some reason. And that's on them, not on us. And so people would say, well, Wendell, you're looking too good. And I would say, isn't that why people got the paper from me in the beginning? To help me be better? But actually, my data says the more you look improved, and more probability the less people are gonna give you. So you have to distribute more papers to get the same amount of return. Whereas before, when you looked just disheveled and out of it, people were, oh, poor you, poor guy, let me give him $10. I don't want that $10 today. You keep it, pay me what the paper is worth. and I'll just sell more units because I don't want pity money and I don't want judgmental money. I don't want you feel sorry for me to help you make you feel better money. So the paper is still continuing to change my life because at 71, I don't have any retirement. I don't have anything that most people at my age usually have to secure their future or to know they don't have any worries in their coming golden years. I have none of that. So selling the paper allows me to maybe have, instead of having an extra value meal life, you know, the McDonald's extra value meal, I now occasionally get to have Chipotle of life. And so selling the paper makes that difference.
In what different ways are you or have you been involved with Street Sense Media? Like, in other words, any events or anything you've done that, you know, do?
I started the paper in 2003. So I've done a lot of things. It just depends on who's the editor, who's the administrator, who's the executive director, how much I get involved and how much I do. It's totally like a total new group of people right now. And I tend just to focus on distributing the paper and occasionally writing something. But in the beginning, we all had to do something to help get that next issue out. And we were all in this little small office, that one office across from the bathroom. Everything was in that one office. And initially we had showers and lockers for the vendors, where we could shower, clean up, and before we went out on the street to distribute the paper. That bathroom is no longer accessible to the vendors, and the paper has moved around the corner. But that office is still being used by the social workers, right? That's the whole paper used to be in that office. On the second floor.
On the second floor. You're talking about the bathroom?
No, where the social workers are now. That was the whole paper. Everything was in that little office.
In that little office, really?
Everything. The whole operation. Wow. Everything. The distribution of the papers, everything in that office.
Well, I didn't know that.
But, you know, it made it tight and it made it warm and it gave it the flavor that made us all feel like we'd found a home away from home. And a lot of us were not only homeless, but we were homeless. We had no place to go back to, or no place to say, let me go home for a minute. And that office became it, that place, for a lot of us early on. The second time I came back to the paper, I had just gotten out of jail. And I walked up from the central cell block. And I was like, I screwed up again. I got nowhere to go, nothing to do. So I walked all the way back up here, and Ted gave me the emergency papers that we used to have. I think it used to be 30 emergency papers. And I want to say I built my business off of those 30 papers that Ted gave me, and I reinvested in myself because I see Street Sense and street newspapers as a vehicle for people to invest in themselves. Mm-hmm. And if you run it like your own business, it can take you some places that you never thought you could go. And then it has the added benefit of the people you meet. For example, I've been selling at this one place for 14 years. And it's on Saturday. So everybody I meet, they have on yoga clothes or jogging clothes or jeans and sneakers. And over the years, I realized, wait a minute, this guy's the police chief. Wait a minute, this guy's a state's attorney. Wait a minute, this guy works for the FBI. Wait a minute, these two women work for a DA, drug enforcement. Because when you first start to have these relationships with them, they just got on jogging stuff, like you would at any farmer's market on a Saturday. And so then I started to make all these connections with people who, without the vehicle of Street Sense, I would not have had a chance to meet. Mm-hmm. Because we're people who normally don't gather. And so the paper gave me an entree into this new world of people who I could find a common denominator with because I didn't know what they did. Mm-hmm. They were just good people who treated me with dignity and respect and recognized me as a human being. And usually after the fact, I find out there's somebody with some influence. It was this one guy who used to get my paper, and I just knew I'd seen him before. And I would dialogue with him like, I know you, right? But I didn't know him. And I subsequently found out he was one of the feature historians on the Ken Burns series about the Civil War and things of that era and the Prohibition Ken Burns series. And it took me maybe 10 years before I figured out that's where I knew him. But the chance that you get to meet so many people can help you in so many ways. Mm-hmm. It's like in 2017, I wrote this story about my experience of going to Jamaica and some things that happened. And I had a friend whose niece worked for a Minnesota paper, Minneapolis paper. And she was in Jamaica doing a story where a paper put her up for a month in a villa. So she said, come on down, pay a ticket and get here. And so some things happened and I wrote a story about that. And I left it, put it down and went on. And then I was informed that that story was nominated for an international award and that I was a finalist. And I never really won anything. I think the only thing I won prior to that I can remember is one time I won a sewing machine in a raffle at a movie opening. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't even sew, but I couldn't even get the sewing machine because to get the sewing machine, you had to commit to buying a cabinet for the sewing machine. Remember? It's a pop-up cabinet. So anyway, so this is my first big to-do, being nominated for something. So I wanted to go to those awards, and those awards were in Scotland. They were in Glasgow, Scotland. And so, I inquired, would I be going to that? And they said, no, we can't send you. So someone says, well, why don't you raise your own money and go? And I had no idea what a GoFundMe was. He says, why don't you start a GoFundMe? I says, okay. And I raised enough money to get me almost to Scotland. And I was maybe, I had to pay for the conference. I had to pay for everything involved. And I was still short, but I had was very happy with what I had raised, but I was still really short. And so somebody that buys the paper regularly, how's it going on your fundraiser? You know, close but no cigar. You know, I feel really good about people's response, but I don't think I'm going to get to make it. And he says, you're going to go. He says, call me later. Why is he telling me this? Get home, I call him. He says, hold on. I'm going to hang up and call you right back. He calls me back with the airline on the line. He pays for my complete ticket from Washington Dulles to Boston to Reykjavik, Iceland to Glasgow, Scotland and back and all the other expenses. And so when I said, almost said his name, and he says he never wants to be mentioned because he doesn't want his wife to know. And so when I say, what do you want me to do with the rest of the money? He says, keep the money, pay some bills, and use it as a little fund for yourself in case an emergency comes up. I only say all this because this points out the power of the paper. And it's what I'm constantly trying to transmit to my brothers and sisters who sell the paper. Don't sell yourself short on what this paper can do to, if not transform your life, but transform some of your conditions. My man paid for everything and told me to keep the balance. I've had people who helped me when I had a problem cashing a check. I had someone give me a check as a donation to help fix one of my raggedy cars. I took it to a well-known bank, and they refused to cash a check, but more importantly, they discriminated me against me openly involving this check. And I relayed that story to somebody who buys my paper, and I come found out they were a civil rights attorney. He says, hey, I want you to call this guy over in Old Town. He's a pit bull. He likes this kind of stuff. So we took that bank through a 2-year process, not to have any monetary determination, but you're going to stop this. And this bank has publicly come under fire for these kind of incidences around the country. Noticing I'm not saying the name of the bank. Okay? So, again, it points out the power of the paper and the opportunities we have as representatives of the paper or ambassadors of the paper, because we're out there on the street having weekly contact with people, and to them, we are the paper after a while. It's not the paper, we're the paper. But more importantly, they are supporters of the movement because they see what it has done for me and other people like me. And that's what makes this movement so great. And that's why I love it. And I'll probably sell the paper as long as I'm physically able to.
So is there something you wish more people knew about Street Sense Media or your work with Street Sense Media? In other words, more Congress or maybe more celebrities we could reach out to? To really get us up.
I was just on Capitol Hill Wednesday, and I was involved in the National Alliance to End Homelessness Lobby Day, where I had the opportunity to talk to 2 senators and 2 congressional representatives from Maryland, my home state. And I did it to assist in the effort, but personally I didn't have a lot of faith in the whole attempt. Personally, I have a disdain for politicians, bureaucrats, anybody in that vein, because I don't see the fruits of any of their conversations about the subjects of homelessness coming to fruition. It's a lot of talk. So, I tend not to want to be involved with that. My work today is I strictly work person to person with people on the street who are suffering from homelessness and mental health issues. So, I just think that our papers, we need to streamline and do more of what we do best. And I'm not a proponent of spreading into other areas for growth reasons or whatever reason. I think we need to streamline and continue to what we do. One of the things I'm most proudest of, and I have my spats with Street Sense, and I have my little arguments and my little run-ins, but when I leave the offices of Street Sense and you catch me on the street, I will tell you how proud I am of Street Sense, and for part of this, for this one main reason. As I travel around the country, and I've been fortunate enough to go around the world where there are street newspapers, we're one of the few street newspapers that is still vendor-driven. Mm-hmm. And by vendor-driven, I mean we have, as close as we can, stuck with the original mission of street newspapers, and that was to empower homeless people and employ homeless people, mm-hmm. get out the message of news and information that's not covered by traditional or what some people would say main media sources. Mm-hmm. I think we've done as good a job as anybody else, and maybe the best job in sticking with that mission, because as I travel, vendors tend to only be the distribution arm of the paper, and they have no other involvement other than to get out on the street and distribute the paper. Some of the papers, especially the European and Canadian papers, I won't name any of them because I don't want to get sued. Vendors aren't even allowed in the office. Vendors have to pick up their papers on the other side of the town in a storefront kind of situation where they have to stand at a counter like you would at a carryout shop or something and get your money, and they give you your papers on the other end of the counter. So I am very proud that Street Sense continues the tradition of access to vendors and vendor involvement and vendor training, because you know, through the back door, this paper and other papers have the potential to rehabilitate people's lives. But you can't say that to people because nobody would sign up for it. But people make that connection. Wait a minute. If I show up on time, I catch my regulars. If I don't, I miss my regulars. I feel that in my pocketbook. If I show up clear-headed, somewhat sober, and dressed in a way that doesn't scare people, I have more money in my pocketbook, and I cement the relations. Those relationships will get so good that when I'm sick or not feeling well, people will inquire. Or if I don't show up at my location on a Saturday or Sunday, some people will call and email me and say, are you okay? Has anybody seen Wendell? But more importantly, if I show up and I'm disheveled, somebody will say, Wendell, are you okay? Mm-hmm. You're not drinking again, are you? And that comment would put some people off. But what I've learned is that demonstrates that now people care about you and you're a part of their community as well. Exactly. So the paper just has this tremendous potential that I do not think is being utilized nationally and internationally because it's the best kept employment secret that I know about. And I'm a case manager and I have clients who are homeless. And when I suggest that, why don't you sell the paper? They're going, are you crazy? Get out on the street and sell a paper? It's kind of hard to get them to buy it. I ain't that's laughing. She know what I'm talking about. I've tried to convert panhandlers to selling the paper. I haven't been successful once yet in all these years. That's because the money comes easy to them. But what they don't grasp is when you get the money easy, you discharge it differently. For example, if some guy gives me $50 coming out of a bar, it's party time. I'm spending that money like New Year's Eve, right? But if I stand on the corner and make $50 selling this paper, at least I'm going to think about that $50 when it's time to spend it and how I need to spend it and what I need and how hard I had to work for it. Exactly. So it's sort of a rehabilitation program underneath of all this, because I think people will individually catch on to these nuances. How about dress? How about appearance? It takes a while for people to get who my customers are. And I learned this in broadcasting. When I first came into broadcasting, I dressed like a rock star and I was having trouble wondering why people weren't dealing with me on the business end. And I had somebody tell me, go to the bank, see what a personal banker looks like, and then watch the Xerox and IBM guys when they come in and look like why they're dressed. They're dressed like that so people can trust them with their money and people can see progress with the money that you give them. So what people on the street are looking for when they give you the 20s and the 10s, they're looking for some progress in you as an individual. They've invested in you as well as the paper. Exactly. And when they don't see that,
the money is no longer there.
It's not going to come. You're going to get $2.
You might not get that.
Absolutely. So, you know, I just think that we have this tremendous potential, and not only in Street Sense, but in the streets newspaper movement that we have yet to really tap into. You know, we're still selling this paper like exclusively for D.C. Mm-hmm. I want to just tell everybody I sell my paper in the suburbs. I do not sell in D.C. because that's where I get a bigger slice of the pie. If I want to sell my paper downtown or Eastern Market, I get a smaller slice of that pie. And so we have to, as a paper, start to give the appearances that we're paying attention to what happens with homelessness outside of the core of D.C. Because I work in a suburban county, and I can tell you, we got encampments, we got people living in tents, we have all of the social ills and issues that D.C. has, but most of those people have never heard of the paper. Mm-hmm. They've never heard of the paper. So it's got to go twofold. We got to start covering things in the suburbs, in homelessness and inequity in the suburbs, which makes it easier to distribute the paper in the suburbs. So I see this vast potential for this paper. But when you mention it to somebody as a solution to their employment, They're going, you got to be crazy. And what I'm trying to tell them is, if you're trying to rebuild your life and you don't have a lot of things going for you, the best as you can hope is an $8 to $10 hour job. And if you sell this paper with any kind of proficiency, you can easily make double that, if not more. Mm-hmm. Easily make double that.
Yeah, you mentioned how Street Sense Media is important to you, and I know how it's important to me.
I might not act like it all the time.
And yeah, I'm telling you, it's a very important paper. And me as a, you know, interviewing you, and of course a vendor myself, you know, it's very important because of the way other people who buy the paper from us, they have a lot of what's that word I'm looking for? They have a lot of.
We break down misconceptions. See, we have the ability to not only be an ambassador for Street Sense newspaper, we also have the ability to be the ambassador to clarifying people's opinions and views of what homelessness is about.
Right.
I say it all the time. Homelessness is just a state of my housing condition, nothing else. It has nothing to do with my ability to comprehend, nothing to do with my ability to achieve, nothing to do with my ability to understand or cement relationships. And so a lot of people are surprised and they will say stuff like, well, you speak so well.
Yeah, I've had that before. And you know what, another thing I've heard people come up to me when I'm selling the newspaper, well, how come this person doesn't speak well, but you speak well? Excuse me, sir. You know, you try to be respectful, you know, and you got to calm yourself down when you're talking to people because you're trying to make a customer. I let them know that, hey, that person might have a speech impediment. Did that occur to you? These are some of the things you have to bring up. But these are suburban people who do not understand, and they never been around anybody with a speech impediment? I don't think so. Yes, they have. But they're trying to make themselves feel better by coming to the big city and trying to make me feel better because I'm black and the person who's got a speech impediment is black, okay, and maybe not dress as well as I do. Well, maybe this is the first time he's been out here, you know. So you have to be kind to all our coworkers and be kind also to the person that's saying these things, but actually they're really being racist and not nice at all.
You know, I have an ever changing view of that dynamic, and that's kind of like the view I had in 1996 when I started with these papers, and I have somewhat transitioned into kind of a different view of that. You know, I learned as a salesperson in the broadcast media that the sales process doesn't start until people say no or reject you. And so it's up to me as a person who's representing the paper, and I'm just talking about me and my approach, and then I don't write them off because those same people wind up becoming regular and dedicated customers of mine. So all they're lacking is an education, first in homelessness and then secondly in the street newspaper movement and how it helps us address homelessness. So I think I would like to see our vendors better prepped and prepared to be ambassadors for the movement and change in addition to or instead of just getting $2 for a paper.
Exactly.
There's a lot of misconceptions out there, and people may perceive if you're able to hold a conversation or have a more than 10 words in your vocabulary that you're different. And I stop right there and I address this. Homelessness has nothing to do with my ability to have a conversation with you.
Exactly.
It has nothing to do with my ability, anything other than the fact that I'm unhoused. And I'll give you an example. I had a roommate in this one transitional house in Cincinnati, Ohio. And he seemed to be in a shell. He seemed to be unapproachable. He seemed to be mean and angry. And he was a big guy. And And one day I was at the soup kitchen at this church where they had breakfast, and they had a piano in the corner. And dude gets up and walks over to the piano. And what I heard next was angelic. It's angelic. It was moving. Everybody in the room calmed down. You couldn't hear a word. We subsequently found out that he was a Juilliard graduate, and then he was a child prodigy on the piano, and he had become homeless. And in that same city, in the Cincinnati Drop-In Center, I became friends with this guy. And I just knew he was another alcoholic like me. And I subsequently found out that he was a Naval Academy graduate from Annapolis, and that he flew F-14 fighter jets, the Tomcat, off the decks of carriers who had untreated mental health, couldn't stop drinking, and wound up on the street. So my state of homelessness is not an indication of my ability to do anything other than secure housing. Mm-hmm. And so when we're out there on the street distributing the paper, because I have difficulty saying when to say distributing, when to say selling, we have these opportunities to debunk these myths about homelessness. And why is that important? Because I may be the only homeless or formerly homeless person that they've ever talked to. And if I screw that up, and then that person is going to probably disseminate that information and opinion to other people in his realm. So we know we have a very important position in the fight to maybe not end homelessness, but to get people to look at homelessness differently. So I think it's very important, because I am very much protective of people selling this paper in terms of how they present themselves. Because I ride around getting out my car to buy papers from people. And I say, well, tell me about the paper. And if they don't do a good job, or I think they're butchering it, and I think they're misrepresenting the paper, I will tell them, here's my badge. It's my name, so-and-so, and you need to do a better job with this paper, because you're hurting us, not in the paper sales, but in the perception from the public. Mm-hmm. If you got your hat turned around backwards, you got a 6X football jersey on and you wear medium, right? It's not a good look for us, because everybody's always judging homeless people. Mm-hmm. They're always paying attention to us, even though they're not saying anything or engaging us. Mm-hmm. So how those of us who are connected with this paper conduct ourselves is very important, not only to the paper, but how people perceive homelessness, homeless people and their ability to change and progress.
Mm-hmm. I agree 100%. You know, but sometimes the other perception that a lot of people have about homelessness is that everybody is lazy, or they all have alcohol or drug abuse, which is not always true, because you can end up homeless because you depleted you lost your job, or you depleted your savings trying to pay rent, keep a roof, and look for another job.
Absolutely.
But it takes almost a year or two to find a decent job.
Absolutely. And I'm going to address that.
It's not like back 30 years ago, back in the 70s, where you lose a job and you can just land into a job within a month or two. I mean, times have changed.
I'm going to address.
It's changed a lot.
Let me address this.
It's not as easy as it was 30 years ago. And we took advantage, and we got complicit. Back in the 70s, let's talk about 52 years ago, we got complicit, and we didn't think nothing would change other than the fact technology came in. And we were already prepared for that back in the 70s and in the 80s, you know, but we got complicit. That's what happened, I think, too, how some of us assume we could just get there and just do what we got to do, but it's not that easy anymore. It really isn't.
Allow me to maybe comment on that. Some of what you say I get, but since I'm a case manager, and right now I have 26 people on my caseload who are unhoused, and my own experience tied into this, I think people forget, even those of us who've experienced homelessness, that homelessness comes in different categories, and certain categories are easier to fix. Mm-hmm. What I hear you describing and what I hear a lot of people describing is what I call, and this is my definitions, and my methodology is not precise to any mathematical degree, nor has it been validated by a study at Harvard or Penn, okay? Mm-hmm. Homelessness comes in, but the main two categories is acute homelessness and chronic homelessness. Mm-hmm. And what I hear you describing is chronic homelessness. And in my experience as a case manager, chronic homelessness is a lot easier to fix, and there's a higher probability that you'll be able to fix it quicker. Because if a person is married, wife kicks him out, get divorced, she's holding all the purse strings, literally. He has no place to go, he falls through the cracks. Then all I need to do is get that guy in some kind of temporary housing, some kind of transitional housing or shelter, while he gets a job, while he gets back on his feet, saves his money, deal with some credit issues, and then he's very easy and go out and get his own apartment and maintain himself. But what I'm talking about and what I see mostly is people who are chronically homeless. I spent 4 years at the 801 East Men's Shelter, specifically the drug program upstairs where I used to work. And we had 535 men in that shelter on a full capacity evening, including the 75 that were in drug treatment upstairs or alcohol treatment upstairs. And the average time that most of those clients had been homeless was approaching between 5 and 15 years of being homeless. It's chronic homelessness. The definition of chronic homelessness has changed over the years, but that's a lot harder to fix because the intrinsic issues that led to that person's homelessness and is repeatedly revisiting homelessness are really, really subliminal, and only the trained mind or trained person or experienced person is going to be able to identify them, let alone lead them down a path to resolving those issues. And that's why people become chronically homeless. They don't know how to live. They've forgotten how to live or never knew how to live. Mm-hmm. And that's a more difficult fix. And in that population, I see more of that unholy triumph of untreated mental illness, drug addiction, and alcoholism. And it is impossible for me to diagnose which one it is because they all mimic the same thing initially until the person gets stable. So you treat them for all three of them. So there's a great percentage of the people that I have on my caseload where alcohol, drugs, untreated mental illness is at the basis of their homelessness. And we have to do a better job of distinguishing them, because we can't use a one-size-fit-all solution with them. The person who's just experienced chronic homelessness with a piece of trauma, as you explained, lost their job, can't pay the rent, that's acute. We can fix that. Mm-hmm. We can fix that. We can give you first month's rent, security deposit, help you get a job, let you stay in the shelter while you save money. How do we support you from here out? We'll support you everywhere we can. It's a whole lot different than people who have been on the street year after year after year, in some cases decades. It was not unusual when I was at 801 East to be able to interact with clients who had been homeless 15 to 20 years and been in the shelter that long. So now I question the methodology we're using in the shelter. And I think we're going in the wrong direction in our shelters, the ones that I'm aware of in the D.C. area. In D.C., I'm not going to say that I think Northern Virginia, Montgomery County has the best approach to helping people rehabilitate their lives. Because, you know, people don't want to admit it. Because we talk about, well, not everybody's an addict, not everybody is a alcoholic. But if I wind up at the same place that alcoholics and addicts and drug people wind up, then the solution is pretty similar. And I say that to say, in my opinion, in my own personal experience, recovering from homelessness, it's like recovering from alcohol or drug or mental illness. There's a regimen. There's a treatment you got to take. Because if not, and it's why we're not making any progress, in my opinion, We're treating the symptoms, not the cause. Mm-hmm. Homelessness is not a virus. You don't catch it. No, because you catch a, you touch a doorknob behind somebody. Mm-hmm. You know, we just went through that with the COVID scare, where we weren't sure how you caught it. Okay? But we thought we caught it from somewhere. And with homelessness, it's some interior work that's got to be done. And so what we continuously try to do is to fast forward to giving them a house. Am I for housing first? No. Donald Whitehead and I go back and forth for hours on this because I've rarely seen housing first done right. Mm-hmm. So I'm not for housing first. What I am is for that old methodical approach to curing homelessness. And a lot of the infrastructure to do that has now disappeared because of gentrification. Let's get that, mm-hmm. let's the gentrification rear its ugly head in this thing. Because right here in D.C., I remember when there were several YMCAs and YWCAs. Right down the street at 9th and G was the largest YWCA in the area. They had a big swimming pool right across from the Martin Luther King Library. Mm-hmm. And that's where everybody went to swim, take swimming lessons. That was in the YW. Mm-hmm. Then you have the, you still have the YW at 9th and Fremont, Phyllis Wheatley. It had another YW. And then you had a YMCA. You got one at 12th and between U and S. It's one at 12th and U, but that's now like a community center because Duke Ellington used to live in that. But and then the
right on 14th Street?
No, no. Oh, it's on 12th Street between T and S. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's called the Anthony Bowen branch. Mm-hmm. But they opened up a new one on V Street. Between 14th and 13th.
Okay, I know.
That's the new Anthony Bowen branch. And that functions more like a Valleys or a health club. But that used to be the solution, was that right in the middle between homelessness and fully returning to your own life with your own domicile. There also used to be gospel missions in every major city. Billy Bob's gospel mission, so-and-so gospel mission, where men and women could go in that transitional period, get support, but more importantly, stabilize. Roof over your head, 3 square meals, get some sleep, address some medical issues, and be safe from being on the street. Because we know it ain't safe living outside on the street. Mm-hmm. Right? They've disappeared.
Yes, they
the
did.
Biggest mission in this area was a city gospel mission at 14th and Q. It is now one of the largest condominiums in D.C.
And they moved further down.
And they traded and put them down by the Union Station in a little small, used to be a school. Mm-hmm. Across the street from that at 14th and Q is one of these old school buildings from the turn of the century. That was the first shelter I worked at. Mm-hmm. It used to be called the Q Street Shelter. That's now a condo. So, you know, with gentrification, we can't speak on homelessness and ending homelessness and why it is what it is, unless we speak about gentrification. It's always going to rear its ugly head because you've taken out the mid-ground where people can't use building blocks or stepping stones to recover from homelessness. The leap is just too big. Even if I give you a rapid rehousing and I send you up on Wisconsin or Connecticut Avenue, as they had in the past, when that 1 year is over, I cannot pay the $3,000 rent or the $2,800 rent. And so that same person 2 years later is back in the cycle of homelessness. And gentrification has a large part of it. And I don't think the community has the stomach to do something about it. Now, organizations like SUM, organizations like Samaritan Inns, who I used to work for, they were lucky enough to buy a lot of property when the property wasn't desirable and valuable. And they provide transitional, permanent, supportive, independent of the city. But they can't afford to do it now because real estate costs too much. You know what it costs to buy an apartment building in D.C. today?
I thought some part of Wilson Building.
Some? Mm-hmm. Some is so others may eat. It's a nonprofit. It's a nonprofit. It's a 61 O Street. It's work for them too. They start
the
off.
Why I say that is because they have apps that are federal government
And let me say this, and I don't want to spend time debating mm-hmm. that issue. It's not why I'm here, but I just want to say that SUM is a nonprofit. It started as a soup kitchen, and it is housed in a former D.C. animal dog pound at 6100. That used to be the city dog pound where SUM is, and they bought the property next to them. They bought some property across the street where it was nothing but junkies and everything on that block. And they have a medical clinic, a dental clinic, everything right there. They all now have segued into government grants and quasi relationships with the government, which I do not approve of.
Right.
Which I do not approve of. Okay. Because see, once you get involved in that process, you can't chart your own course because you have to worry about what the grant source, what their expectations is. I just got finished working 2 years on a SAMHSA grant in Arlington, Virginia for people opioid addicted who are underinsured or no insured. And at the end, after my second year, it was very clear to me that our grant was based upon producing a certain set of statistics that validated the hypothesis of the whoever that gives you the money. So I prefer not to be in that world, but no, SUM is a nonprofit. They do some tremendous work, and they bought a lot of real estate. Mm-hmm. They bought a lot of old warehouses in that 4th and T Street Northeast.
Was this recently? No.
They've owned this property for years and years and years. They've got several what you would call to be transitional houses that are now permanent dwellings where a person has like an efficiency size apartment there. And then Samaritan Inns has several buildings, two on Colorado Avenue Northwest near the Rock Creek Park Tennis Center, all between Georgia and 13th Street and 14th Street, right where Colorado, Kennedy, 14th, and what's that street down in the park? Not Arkansas. It's one of those state streets right in there. Colorado. Colorado, 14th, Kennedy. All those streets come right together.
Oh, they've got Petworth area.
Barely in Petworth before you get into mm-hmm. Brightwood.
Right.
And they've got two or three apartment buildings that they bought way back when.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a nonprofit can't afford to buy an apartment building in Northwest DC now.
Mm-hmm.
And so other than those, and the waiting list to get in those is so backed up. And part of the reason it's backed up is because it has gone from being temporary supported housing to where it's now a destination. And the same thing is happening in those facilities that has happened in our public housing. And it's like a log jam. Nobody can get in because nobody's going out. Nobody's leaving public housing. Nobody's leaving transitional housing. So those who really need it, who are homeless, they're backed up because they can't get into supportive situations because people, in my opinion, stay too long. Okay, this was not meant to be a permanent destination. It was supposed to be help along the way.
Okay, what is something you want people to know about your story that you think is often misunderstood?
We talked about it early. One of the things I want people to understand is my ability to engage, or some people may say you're charismatic, or you're well-spoken, or I could tell you're smarter than. And what they're really trying to say is I'm special. And I'm not.
Yeah, you are.
I'm a garden variety homeless person trying to recover and live a better life. There's nothing special about me that any other homeless person can't accomplish. Everything that I've done is doable for every other homeless person, especially those who associate themselves with this paper. They just got to see it and believe it, because I'm a strong believer in practicing a principle of positive thinking and the power of my mind, and the power of thought leads to action. I'm a proponent and a practicer of a discipline called The Secret. where in that discipline, if I visualize something and say this is what I want, it stops right there. If I get into how I'm gonna get it, what the obstacles to getting it are, or I can't afford it, then I don't get it. Okay, I am a strong proponent of that kind of discipline of living, and my life over the last 10 or 15 years bears that out, because I've gone places and done some things and secured some things that were totally unbelievable for me 15 years ago. If you would have said, what is it you want out of your recovery from homelessness or your association with papers, I wouldn't have had a clue. I would have sold myself vastly short on the potential now. And that's why my column is called Random Acts of Kindness. Because all of these good things that have happened in my life, when I go back and examine them and start writing about them, there's always some faceless person in some cases that I don't remember their name or what they look like, was the person who facilitated this great thing in my life happening by their just momentary act of kindness and looking upon me with favor. And without that act, a lot of what I'm experiencing wouldn't have took place, or the foundation wouldn't have been laid. And those people ride off to the sunset being unaware of what they just did for me. Totally unaware that this little moment changed my life. And in their life, it was just another instance of them being compassionate and good people. What I've learned through Selling Streets is there's some great people out here. Mm-hmm. And all hues and all backgrounds and all locations. But being able to transmit to them my humanity and not my homelessness was the key to people buying into me and wanting to support me in everything I do. Even to this day, there are people I can call and say, I have a client that has no winter clothes. Mm-hmm. And I've had them say, what's a good time for you, Wendell? I'll meet you over Potomac Yards, or I'll meet you at Rivertown. And they pull up, go in Target, tell the person, go ahead and shop. And we get to the counter, they pay for it, they get back in their car, and they drive away. And I say, hey, do you want to receive this? No, Wendell, keep three. Mm-hmm. And they're gone. There are good people out here. Mm-hmm. And most of them don't want any public credit
right. For
the good things that they do. And so being involved with Streets and distributing Streets, since there's that dilemma of whether I say sell or deliver, mm-hmm. or distribute again, has allowed me to say, wait a minute, there's some great people out here of all backgrounds and all persuasions. Mm-hmm. And so what I've found over the years, it's been my prejudices that have tainted my assessment of people, not theirs, because I've seen too much kindness. I've seen too much caring. So sometimes I have to catch myself when I say, people don't care about homeless people. I have to change that and say, some people don't care about homeless people. And those who are in that category are those who we certainly haven't broke through and educated them fully about homelessness yet. Mm-hmm. They're potential allies. Even the ones we think are the most dismissive and the most racist and all that stuff, they're potential allies. Because mm-hmm. I've had people who treated me real nasty and became great supporters. Mm-hmm. Like a guy, I was in Alexandria one night. Guy pulls up on a Harley Davidson, big, loud Harley. He's got all leather and turquoise and silver. And his girl, she's on the back. They got all leather and turquoise. And they backed the motorcycle up to where I was standing. And they got off the motorcycle, and I, hey, sir, you know, he helped us with the baby, blah, 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 in my spiel. And he looked at me like I was crazy, real dismissive. And my feelings was hurt. And so I wanted to label him all those things. Mm-hmm. Because his image was the image of the kind of guy I would be fearful of, or would think that he didn't like me or hated me because of. You feel me? Mm-hmm. So later on, maybe an hour or two later, they come out the club. He walks by me, hands me some bills. I didn't even look to see what it was. He pressed them in my hand. He says, good work. I like what you're doing. Got on his motorcycle, cranked up, drove off. I'm like, what just happened? I opened up the thing. It was six $20 bills. So we never know.
Mm-hmm. You never know.
Our job is to carry the message.
Mm-hmm.
We don't control how the message is received and how it's rewarded. Our job when we're out there with the paper is just to carry the message. And it is an important job. That's not understating. I think too many of our vendors don't understand that because they're maybe fixated on personal gain or personal return for that interaction. And they don't see themselves as an ambassador for all of us. If one of us screws up, it affects all of us. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get too preachy here, but you can see that I believe in this paper. Mm-hmm. It has changed my life. Mm-hmm. It has changed my life because I was going nowhere fast. And because I was spinning my wheels. And I'm just waiting for this opportunity that I didn't know where it was going to come from. And something as low tech as taking a bundle of papers and standing out on a corner and talking to people literally changed my life, literally, in a lot of ways that I can't even talk about in this anyway. I got my first couple cars as a result of selling this paper. I had a raggedy car once, and it kept overheating. And this lady said, well, why don't you try my mechanic? I can't afford to get my car fixed. I'm just going to put some water in. So I was riding around with bottles of water in the back. You know, those antifreeze bottles, right? And so when it overheats, I just stop, put some water in, just wait, right? And just drive a little more. I said, so I'll just take it to my guy. So I took it to her guy in Alexandria. I get a call. The guy says, your car's ready. And so when I go to pick up the car, I'm looking for this bill that I can't afford to pay. And so the guy says, well, we fixed this, we fixed that, we fixed that, we needed this, they needed that. I'm like, oh, wait a minute. I didn't say fix any of that stuff. And he said, don't worry about it, it's all been paid for. I said, by who? The people don't want to know, want you to know. I wrote a story about it in Street Sense, for those who are listening. It's a story I wrote about that in Street Sense. Whoever it was paid for my whole repair bill, and I think I had about a 91 Camry that I was trying to keep running. And I'm saying these are the miracles that I've experienced as a result of my interactions with some of the best people out there. The people who reject me, who are mean to me or dismissive to me, they don't count. They're more than overshadowed by the people who engage me and treat me human. Okay, they know my birthday, they know how many kids I got, and blah, blah, blah over the time. But this is over 20 years. And I think all of the vendors who take the right approach to this paper can experience some of the same things I've had.
Okay, so what changes would you like to see made in terms of addressing homelessness as an issue at the governmental level?
Well, it's funny you should ask that because I just left Capitol Hill. I was on Capitol Hill virtually Wednesday all day. And I got to speak to two senators and two congressmen from Maryland. So I won't mention their names, but it's easy to guess the senators, right? Because there's only two. And what I found was that they were really nice. And they were supportive on the surface. And since I'm not a person with any kind of ambitions career-wise or political-wise, I tend to be more like I'm from Missouri. I'm not paying attention to what you say. Show me. Show me where what you did filtered down to the person on the ground who's suffering and made a difference. And so what I found was I was involved in a hug fest for 9 hours. You know, a hug fest. And I had to remind people I'm not here for the hug fest. I can hug myself. What I want is something tangible from this day. And so all I really heard them say was they were agreeable to getting the same appropriations that they have in the past. And I had to remind one young legislative aide who was young enough to be my grandchild that, you know, at this current funding level that the government continuously to push our way to fight this problem, it only allows us to tread water. I'm using a swimming pool term. Only allows us to tread water. We're not sinking, but we ain't swimming either. Mm-hmm. And what I'd like to see is a breaststroke, a backstroke, or some kind of swimming towards a destination. Mm-hmm. And right now, They grant us so many billion and all this kind of stuff, and we're essentially just treading water with everything. I talked to, almost said his name. He's running for state's attorney general from Maryland. So I didn't say his name, but I gave you a hint. And his office is telling me, well, you know, we're on your side. And on my side, to me, is different from you vigorously advocating for me. See, I told him that I need to see the senators and congressmen who supposedly support us to really make other senators and congressmen uncomfortable. I mean, on the left, uncomfortable. We didn't have not one Republican who agreed to see us. On the left, ramp it up, right? We're asking for a leap in money. We're not asking for the same money because every year puts us behind. We'll be right back a year or two from now asking for the same amount of money. Then if you gave us enough money, right, we can make some headway. So we're not making any headway. We're making just enough money to what's that word called, a march in place, not military. When you march in place, but you're not going nowhere, but you like you're marching. That's what we're getting here. Mm-hmm. We're asking for an increase from 1.3 billion to 1.6 billion in money to, I'll make sure I don't get this wrong. I think it's to prevent homelessness. And then we're asking from 20 some billion to 31.2 billion in money for more vouchers and all that kind of stuff. It is a significant increase that we're asking. And I could tell already that those politicians are ready to dial back and give us what we normally get or close to that, but not that leap we really need to make a real impact. So we'll be back in 3, 4 years, 2 years or whatever, asking for the begging. And I don't like begging because I felt that's what we did Wednesday on Capitol Hill. Mm-hmm. And in all the cases but one, we talked to a legislative assistant who I said was about the age of my grandkids. And they gave us hot 15, 20 minutes, and I'm going to take this back to the congressman. I have absolutely no faith in what's going to come from the Capitol Hill Day, Legislation Day. I think communities have got to solve their own homeless issues and not wait for the federal government. I think churches have to solve the homeless issue, synagogues and mosques have to solve the homeless issue and not wait for the federal government. But right now, everybody's tainted because they're feeding at the trough of the federal government money through grants and appropriations. And they're lining up mega churches that's got millions of dollars are feeding at that trough as well. I will give you one example. The African-American or the black woman's female sorority of Delta Sigma Theta. They have built 2 senior citizens building on 8th Street in Northeast, right at the Heckinger Mall. Mm-hmm. One is called Delta Towers, it's like 10 stories, and then there's another one. See, I think you do that and not wait on the government. Okay, but I'm sure some HUD money involved in that because this is what we do now. But I do believe that private entities can make a difference. There's an organization called the Carpenter Shelter in Alexandria, Virginia. And it's called the Carpenter, meaning Jesus, because he was a carpenter. I think people forget he was mm-hmm. a carpenter. His father was a carpenter. He was mm-hmm. a carpenter. All private money. All volunteer-driven. Mm-hmm. They just built a new 8-story state-of-the-art that includes shelter, transitional housing, permanent supportive housing, and senior housing. Mm-hmm. On their own, pretty much. And I'm sure they got some government money, maybe. But they did it, planned it, and got the ball rolling on their own. And I just don't trust that politicians have the will to tackle this problem. The only time recently that I've heard really politicians engage it at a level that would have national impact was when Larry Elder was running against Gavin Newsom for governor of California in the recall race. Homelessness was the number 2 topic in that race. And for a minute, we had national figures talking about homelessness. It has now receded to the background as homelessness gets worse. And just to give you a quick example, I just had a guy who was living in the woods. He had been put out of his apartment, and he had his stuff in the woods set up like an apartment. Dining room, living room, kitchen, tables, chairs. He even had a vase or vase with flowers in it sitting on the table outside in the woods. And that tells me that recently he had an apartment. Mm-hmm. And I'll show you pictures when I'm finished. He had an apartment. But last week he was killed on the highway riding his bike to his encampment. Wow. So when you look at it this way, I say, why wasn't there funding to keep him from being evicted? So he wasn't living in the woods. So he wasn't riding his bike back to his encampment in the woods. And I think that's where we got to go. We continuously try to pull people out of the stream. And we've got to take a page out of Bishop Desmond Tutu's book, who said, we have to stop pulling people out of the water. And we got to go way upstream and figure out why they're falling in. And that's why we won't solve homelessness, in my opinion, using the methods that we currently use and the strategies, because we're not dealing with why they fell in. We're only trying to fix it by giving them a house. And on my caseload right now, more than half of the people on my caseload had housing in 2021 and 2022. But yet they've recycled back to homelessness, which convinces me, again, we're putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah.
And when they're acute homelessness, as I said earlier, it's easy to fix. Get a guy a job. Give him a place to stay while he saves some money. Give him first month's rent security deposit to help him get on his way. Mm-hmm. But these chronically homeless people, it's not an easy fix. Mm-hmm. It's not an easy fix.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Wendell Williams. You did a wonderful job explaining everything about...
This is what I believe. Not precise to any mathematical degree. This is what I believe.
Well, that's what... Yeah, you got a wonderful background, and I really appreciate it. And I just want to tell you from... a vendor to another vendor, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I think you are special. I think all of us are special.
Well, you know, we have a tumultuous relationship.
Every vendor is special.
It is.
Media.
Because every special vendor, check this out. Every vendor is me at some point during my metamorphosis. As a vendor and a human being, every vendor represents where I was at a certain point. Mm-hmm. Which causes me to be more empathetic mm-hmm. and more patient with their process as people were patient with my process.
Okay, well, we're wrapping it up. So thank you very much.